there could be a business that could transform this situation. Business is the engine for change, if you like, because it is unlimited in its growth potential.
In every city, there's five people that are sort of known by everyone and influential in the city. And working out who those five are, because those are the five who will basically be able to open doors to you across the city. And so from the beginning, we've been constantly seeing who have we got and what have they, what could they become? The crossover between is it genuinely life-giving and can people excel at it?
And I love the challenge of how much value can we add in an hour and a half. Often these companies just haven't often considered that there is a way within their business to create that social impact that they're looking for.
So networking is interesting because we're all basically meeting in an artificial setting, trying to get what we want from the person we meet and then working out who else we should be talking to because this person isn't going to give us what we want.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 3 of the Leading Boldly podcast. I'm Matt Clutterham.
I'm Jenny Jarvis.
Today, we are really lucky to have a superstar with us, Michael Gladwell. Michael is Head of Enterprise and Strategy at Upbeat Communities, one of the fastest growing social enterprises in the UK, is Entrepreneur in Residence at Derby University, founded Derby Language School 7 years ago as a social enterprise for Upbeat Communities. He continues to manage Derby Language School alongside Upbeat Clean, a newer enterprise that employs refugee mums as commercial cleaners and actually celebrates its third birthday today, the day we're recording. So congratulations, Michael, on a massive milestone and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Matt. And Jen, it's really great to be here.
It's great to have you. Right, who's going to start then?
Go for it.
Okay, so what inspired you firstly to create Derby Language School as a social enterprise for Upbeat Communities? Are they linked, Upbeat Communities and the Language School, or are they separate?
Yes, so Upbeat Communities is about 15 years old. It's a charity that owns Derby Language School and Upbeat Clean. So I was working, it was actually 12 years ago, I was working for Upbeat Communities as a sessional teacher. And I was really aware that there was a big challenge for keeping our classes for refugees going. So there's a big challenge for refugees and asylum seekers in Derby to find English classes. And funding kind of starts and stops according to the interests of the funder. And so I basically looked at how can we make a model whereby we can make enough profit to be able to provide non-stop classes for refugees and asylum seekers in the city of Derby. So Derby Language School was started as a social enterprise to generate profit. Which it does, it generates somewhere between £30,000 and £80,000 a year. And that money is used to help sustain our English class provision, which let's say for Upbeat Communities last year provided English classes for around 500 individuals, free classes for those individuals. So the profit from Derby Language School goes through to help provide those classes with Upbeat Communities.
What got you to that point of wanting to do all of this? What is your backstory?
Yeah, I think I've always been interested in business. My mum ran a Kit McGrath Centre. My granddad was a relatively successful businessman in Haulage. And so I think I've always been interested in business, and I've also been interested in how can we help others? How can we make sure that there is genuine opportunities for all people in the city, whatever city I'm in. So I think when I was 22, it was kind of thinking, there could be a business that could transform this situation. Business is the engine for change, if you like, because it is unlimited in its growth potential. And so it's thinking, what is the business or social enterprise that could mean that a few years from now, refugees and asylum seekers across the city have as much access to ESOL as they need? And Derby Language School, I think for me, was just the interesting vehicle that we could try to do that with.
What languages do you speak?
That's always an embarrassing question. So I speak English and a very small amount of many other languages. To be honest, I don't really have the follow through when it comes to languages. I did Arabic for 6 months about 2 years ago. And then the social enterprises just took over again. So I actually don't teach at the language school either anymore. So for me, really, my passion is business. And luckily, I have teachers who are phenomenal linguists.
And I think it is a funny thing over here, where in England, so many countries speak our language. And for us, it's like, which one do we choose? Because if we choose Spanish, we could speak it in a lot of Spanish speaking countries, but it wouldn't help us in France. If we speak French, it would help us, you know. So it's always like, which one do we choose? And as you say, you speak many, many bits of lots of languages, and that's a great skill too.
Yeah, thanks, Jenny, for changing that into a really positive answer.
I'm good at that. Yeah. It's my job. Go on, Matt. You're up next.
So you're leading the way in these organisations and leading change in Derby itself. How would you describe yourself as a leader?
I think I like a good challenge. I love to know what I'm trying to build and to have a really clear picture of that. And then I love to bring as many people as possible in on that challenge. So I'm definitely not a lone ranger. I really enjoy communicating with people, bringing people alongside, convincing people, and seeing what kind of team I can build around a cause. And so that's probably my main leadership style, I think, yeah.
I think you've got such a solid presence. When we first met you, it was in networking, and you've just got such a lovely, calm nature and friendly and welcoming, mm-hmm. I find. That's how I found you straight away. Very welcoming, very level, very calming. And that really appealed to me.
Thank you. I think it helps when you've got a cause and a business that you sort of, to my core, I believe in it. So it is my values at work. I want to see, you know, when it comes to Upbeat Clean, for example, I genuinely am endlessly frustrated that refugee women, many of whom I know, simply couldn't find that first job. And so being able to grow a business that you can actually genuinely live out your values through and enables you to have that integrity, I think, when you meet people, because I'm as passionate about it as I appear, because it is everything that I want to do right now. So, no, I think that helps.
What drove you towards refugee women specifically in helping them? Because we all know there's many, many problems in the world and we can't solve them all. So what made you want to solve that particular issue?
That was, I think, at the beginning. So Derby Language School was doing very well as a social enterprise already. And I think as a charity, we were just really aware of a big, big challenge in the city where a lot of the refugee women that the charity were directly supporting in all different kinds of ways just weren't finding that first job. So were stuck unemployed with young families. And that was really holding back the whole family. And I think I'm not the kind of person necessarily that feels empathetic towards people I don't know. So it's not a conceptual thing so much for me as needing to know 10 of those individuals and happening to bump into them at the charity building and just seeing again and again this issue and then going, I know these guys have a problem. I know I've got the business skills to sort this. Like I simply can't just walk on by and just assume that, you know, I've done my bit. I've started Derby Language School. That's fine now. So it was, I think, you know, do to others as you would have them do to you is a phrase that's, you know, been used religiously for years. But actually, I genuinely think would I want that for my family? Let's say I died and my wife and kids went to another country because of war. I would be gutted if there wasn't someone there helping them with language provision and then helping my wife with work. And so, yeah, genuinely, it's like, what could I do to help and to pass on that favour that I am in the privileged position of doing?
And they've all got a really amazing work ethic. They want to work.
Yeah, no, and that is the joy of running a commercial cleaning business with people who are absolutely chuffed to have had that opportunity. Is that many of them have never earned £12 an hour in their lives. They've never had pension and sick pay and a manager who genuinely cares about them. They've never worked in the kind of places that we clean. We clean museums, art galleries. And I think when people grateful for what they have, they just work fantastically well. So it is a joy to run because we've got a team of 30 cleaners who are just genuinely hardworking, turn up day in, day out, and just want to prove us right, that, you know, that they are those incredible people that they are.
Yeah, amazing. Well, one of the questions I've got around that is, we've talked about you as a leader, but you're empowering a lot of these women to step up within the business at different levels and take on leadership roles themselves. How do you do that? How do you go about that with people who might not necessarily have been a leader before or even see themselves as leaders outside their own home?
Yeah, interesting. I think it is a big challenge for us. I genuinely want to replace myself. It's not something I just say. I want Upbeat Clean to be led as soon as is practically possible by a refugee woman, ideally, because I think there's an integrity in that. Having said that, it is a challenge to work out what speed is right to do that. And so for us, it's about finding the individuals we have and then looking at their skills, getting to know them genuinely as people, and then working out, actually, you could be a fantastic cleaning manager. Maybe you couldn't be an operations manager due to either language or skill sets, but what if I gave you two teams to manage it over four or five venues? And so from the beginning, we've been constantly seeing who have we got and what could they become? And then making sure that they're leading as many of the discussions as possible. So I think I sent you guys the other day, whenever we have a meaningful decision to be made, it always goes to our leadership team. And all the veto votes are owned by the two refugee managers who we've got in our team, because I want that they know what is best for their community, not me. So I can have a lovely idea, you know, maybe we should do spring cleans for domestics, because we don't do domestics. And I launch that to them, having done a whole pile of work on it, and they go, I don't think that'd be life-giving for our staff. And I go, oh, okay, well, let's scrap that plan then. So it's working out how quickly and how in an empowering way can we share this leadership so that in the future we can actually transition to the point where I can pull back fully. But also being practical about that, because it is a lovely idea, isn't it, to just bring in someone quickly. But actually, that isn't what creates the biggest social outcome. It is looking really at the genuine aim, which is to end this social issue in Derby in the next 10 years, and going, what can we do to make sure that we can achieve ending the social issue of refugee women not finding their first job in Derby? It's a very long sentence. In the next 10 years, how do we bring that as quickly as possible? And how do we empower refugee women in that process as much as possible at the same time?
Yeah, amazing. You said a really key phrase during that. You used the phrase life-giving. And I know you've got a very specific model around which you operate the business, around being life-giving. And it's actually so inspiring. We've taken it on here at Key Branch and we've used it here. But tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so for us as a social enterprise team, it's our obsession. It's, if you picture, what do you call those two circles where they cross over?
A Venn diagram.
Yes. If you picture a Venn diagram and you have that image of the crossover between, is it genuinely life-giving and can people excel at it? And so we constantly have this sentence, we're creating work where it's genuinely life-giving for all of our staff. That's our cleaners and our managers. And we're looking for that crossover where we can excel at it. And that's where we're trying to build the business obsessively. And so it's the question before we take on any new work, any different types of work, before we look at expanding or bringing in new employees, is will this genuinely create that perfect mix of life-giving work where our staff can excel? Because once we do that, one, we're fulfilling our aim, which is to empower refugees through our businesses. But two, actually, we're also, on a selfish sense, that's going to create the best business, because while your staff are having life-giving work where they're excelling, they're fulfilled, they're feeling rewarded, they're continuing to excel because they know it's achievable to excel, and you create that stunning culture, which I think we're developing really nicely, which is where you've got staff at all levels feeling like they are genuinely cared for, but also stretched. And that's just a really nice balance to try and strive for.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do you incentivize businesses to take on Upbeat Clean as their cleaning providers?
How do we incentivize them? I guess it's trying to understand what businesses really want in this situation. Obviously, businesses are looking for excellent cleaning that's reliable and affordable. That's the gut instinct is just to build a business around that. But actually, I think there is something much deeper that big businesses, and specifically in medium-sized businesses, are looking for, which is to have that social impact in their city in a scalable way. In the past, you used to do a special jumper day. where, you know, a massive business would raise £200 for cancer research, and everyone put their money in and be like, that's fantastic. And then you think, that's a multi-million pound business, and they raise 250 quid for that charity twice a year. Surely there's something where they can have the size of social impact that their size justifies. And so I think talking to business about what they want to do in the city, a lot of businesses, we work with Getinger and Valent, for example, two very large businesses, or Reach Events, for example. These are big companies that have a big desire to create genuine social impact in the city and say, look, your cleaning budget is 20 to 70K a year. What if you could use that budget to change lives? What if because of your boring cleaning budget, you could change the lives of somewhere between 3 and 7 refugees per vast building? It's interesting, is that incentivizing, or is that just opening up a possibility for them to achieve the goals that they didn't realize were even possible? Often these companies just haven't often considered that there is a way within their business to create that social impact that they're looking for. So it's just connecting ourselves, I guess, and partnering with them together so that we can change the lives that they want to and that we want to. So
that's brilliant. It's such a great model. And currently, where are you based?
So we're based in Derby. And so we generally try to find those jobs that are within the city centre and Pride Park areas. Again, it's working out, is it life-giving? Can we excel at it? Sending our cleaners 4 hours to travel somewhere or 2 hours to travel somewhere to do a 2-hour job and then 2 hours back, is it life-giving for them? And we can't excel at managing it well. And so we really obsess over trying to keep our region actually as small as possible in quite an unusual way for a good-sized cleaning business. So we're generally trying to find within a mile of the city centre these really nice places with companies that share our values that want to partner with us to do this.
So what if people are listening and thinking, this is a great idea for our local community? What would you suggest that they do?
In terms of starting a cleaning business or in terms of...
Starting, like, Upbeat Clean could be a great model for other places.
Yeah, so we're actually looking at how we can help other areas and other charities particularly to start their own version of Upbeat Clean. We're actually at the moment packaging up our operations manuals, our marketing stuff, our contracts, our training, all of that stuff into one package that we can give to charities who are interested in starting a clean business. Because I genuinely think that there is, I mean, I did the research on 40 different social enterprise options to reach Upbeat Clean. And my summary of that research was, there's nothing more scalable that you can provide that level of that number of jobs in a really accessible way to a large group of people than a commercial cleaning business. So I would encourage them. I'd say get in touch because, yeah, that's we would love to help other people start socially minded cleaning businesses.
So for anybody out there that's thinking about this and thinks, oh, that's a good idea, we will put Michael's details in the show notes so that you can contact him.
Yeah, absolutely. And what are some of the innovative strategies that you've employed in building the enterprises that you think other social enterprises could learn from?
I think building with the end in mind, is it Jim Collins that talks a lot about that, starting with the end in mind?
It's, isn't it Stephen Covey?
Yeah, Stephen Covey, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I genuinely think there's probably there's nothing better than doing that. Like, if you want to change society in a meaningful, scalable way, then I think it's defining the social impact that we want. What are we genuinely passionate about? Who are we genuinely passionate about? What's the size of the change we want to create? And then working backwards from that point and saying, is this business idea that I've got one that can be scalable to reach that? Because often social enterprises are started because that's a hobby interest of the individual starting it already. They already like doing this, making this. And then they think, oh, I can make that into a social enterprise. Now, that is one way of choosing a social enterprise option. I would encourage social entrepreneurs always to start with the problem. And they talk about, you know, fall in love with the problem, not your solution, so that you can make sure that you're actually building something that will actually create the social impact you're wanting to create. And then from that, really just solid planning. like really thinking through 90-day planning, strategically thinking, what is it that I need to work on in my business all the time so that we're not lost in the cloud? You guys know this as business owners, that it's so easy to get lost in the day-to-day practicalities of a business and not move forward. But having that, having someone, potentially a coach who can tell you, you know, what are you working on at the moment? What are you transforming in your business and why? And continuing to remember to do that over a sustained period of time, I think is probably the secret to how we've developed, definitely. And I think what social entrepreneurs generally need to keep coming back to.
How do people start with the funding aspect of it? Because I think that puts a lot of people off.
Yeah, social enterprises are interesting because you can, depending on how you set up, attract funding. So we've had over £40,000 worth of investment over the first 3 years to help us scale quickly. So it's different from a normal business. A normal business, obviously, you put your own money in, your family, friends and fools put money in. And then at some point, the bank might put money in. So every business really to scale quickly requires investment. Social enterprises are often a bit different in that you can write grants, and that grants are actually really interested. If you can prove your model and say, we want to grow. So I've just written one recently for a grant for 18 grants that we can invest in lead generation marketing in a really interesting way for a social enterprise. And I basically said, we want to grow from around 400K to a million over the next 3 years. This is one of the things. If we can work out how we can buy customers through this, paying for lead generation and then creating a funnel, if we can work out how to do that through this, we could grow from 400 to a million, which will create 100 jobs instead of 40 jobs at any one time. So we need that investment to do that. And so it's just a different model. It's a different way of thinking about investment. But definitely, like, it's key that we attract investment, because if we don't invest financially, we're not going to be growing at the speed we need to address the problem we want to address.
Yeah. And attracting that all comes down to the model, right?
You've got to have a good model, I think. Yeah. I mean, you can attract a small amount to prove your model, but the sooner you can prove that model well and sell that story to funders like you would investors, it's the same, it's the same thing, isn't it? It's just that they're having different outcomes in mind. But yeah, I think it's all about, can we scale this big? Because I don't want to waste my time creating two good jobs. You know, I want to get to 100 where we can actually end this social issue in the city. And to do that, we need to think, how do we get that kind of investment where we can aggressively grow quickly?
Amazing. So, entrepreneur in residence at Derby University. Tell us about that.
Yeah, really fascinating. It wasn't something I was looking for. The university approached me and asked me if I would be interested. Really, they're looking at how they can develop entrepreneurship across the university. And I think it's a fascinating idea for so many students. How do we help those? So a lot of students will obviously go into employment, but actually there should be a reasonable number of them that actually could, while they're at uni, start to develop enterprises or social enterprises. But needing that support, how do you, like, who is it that's going to give you that coaching, that mentoring, that little bit of challenge, or that lot of challenge, depending on what you need at the right time? And it's been a real joy to be able to do that with the uni for the last couple of months, and hopefully ongoingly. I started Derby Language School while I was studying my degree. And it is a great time to start something meaningful, because you're not expected to get a proper income while you're studying. So it's actually a great time to start a business. And you're not potentially so lonely. You've got friends around you. So it's actually a really good time in life to think, what could I build that's going to be meaningful for me in the next 10 years? And it's a joy just to work with these individuals to see if I can be part of that journey and help them along.
So how do you go about inspiring the entrepreneurial spirit in the students? What does a kind of typical day look like?
So the Entrepreneur Residence at the moment is largely a coaching and mentoring program. So it's working out, what are their sort of five or six things they need to work on? Is it, as we talked about, business planning or defining the end goal? Is it working out their customer journey? Is it looking through their budgets and working out how they're going to get a salary from this in the next 2 years? All of these different elements are potentially more or less developed, and often less developed, because a lot of people focus on the product they're trying to build and forget about the business that it's going to actually be selling or functioning in order to make this product last. So it's working out at the beginning what would add the most value in the sort of four or five sessions that I'm going to work with this individual on. And then being that person who asks the questions, the challenging questions, and giving feedback where possible in an appropriate way to encourage them, but also to challenge them and go, this could be more if you shaped this slightly differently, or have you considered this as an option? So yeah, it is an interesting balance between coaching and mentoring.
What sort of age group are they?
So far, it's been somewhere between 25 and 65.
Oh, okay.
And Literally everywhere in the middle, because you've students at Derby Uni are really a broad range of ages. And so that's also been really enjoyable to see at the total, like a real range of spectrum of stages of life and experience.
What do you get out of it personally? I sense quite a lot. So,
yeah, I think for me, I've had a coach for years, Tony Pruitt, and he has been absolutely fantastic for me. And I think it's inspired me that's something I'd like to do more of in the future. I would imagine 10 to 15 years from now, largely doing coaching and mentoring. That'd be what I really enjoy. And so it's a great chance for me to do that with students and to see these exciting programs, see these exciting topics and excited people, and see what value I can add. And I love the challenge of how much value can we add in an hour and a half. For me, I guess maybe that shouldn't be my obsession, but it is. Like I love to think in this hour and a half, what is the most that we can build together in terms of challenging a new idea or developing something totally fresh? And then looking back and going, yeah, that was a really genuinely valuable use of an hour and a half. I'd encourage anyone to get involved and to do it. Yeah.
There is nothing better as a coach than seeing all those light bulb moments and then them taking action. And it's great. And I think you're absolutely ideal for that role.
Yeah. And I think if you're a coach that asks the questions and lets them form the answer, you get to next time see the fact they actually followed through on it as well. And I think that's what I love about coaching more than mentoring, is that when you've asked them a few questions and they've realized for themselves something totally fresh, possibly that you also weren't even trying to push them towards, not that you should as a coach, but you know what it's like. You're asking questions because you think you know the answer, and then they come out with something better. And then because they came out with it 3 weeks later, they've actually acted on it. And it's brought that significant change. And that's been fascinating.
Yeah.
So you're a busy guy, multiple enterprises, entrepreneur at the university. How do you balance that with things you enjoy? I understand you like allotments and gardening. How do you find the balance?
Well, the allotment has suffered almost entirely. But I do find a reasonable balance, I think. I rarely work more than a 40-hour week, which I think surprises a lot of small business owners. I think I probably work very fast when I'm focused, and I try to really, because I've got those three goals for this quarter as an obsession, it helps me to focus on three things as opposed to, like most entrepreneurs, 15 things that I kind of should want to develop that I am only going to start all of and then not to finish off with. So I think that really helps me to keep balanced in my work-life balance. And then, it's just working out how can I enjoy the rest of my time with my family. I've got two young kids, so to be honest, the work life is not the hardest part, is it? When you've got an 8 and a 9-year-old, you're hardly coming from work to relax. You're coming home from work to work on the next challenge of thinking what you're going to do with these little monkeys. So I enjoy that as well, but it's definitely adds fun to life.
Do you do any mindset coaching type stuff with them, and are they amenable to it if you do?
Interesting. I try. There's a sort of parenting model where you offer a lot of choices and you allow them to experience the end result of their choices. And that would definitely be the way that I try to parent as much as possible. So, you know, would you like this or would you like this? And, you know, occasionally helping them understand the outcome of those choices and occasionally just letting them experience the outcome of those choices. So I guess that is a form of coaching parenting in a way. I'm looking forward to them getting to sort of 12, 13, 14, where we can start to really talk through topics in a more complex way. They're fascinated by the businesses I run. And I'm very open with them, including numbers, profit margins, salaries. I try and talk honestly with them about the whole lot. Because, you know, I learned a lot from my mum. I used to talk to my mum about her profit margins running this tuition centre and how she could increase that if she changed this, or would that impact on the number of students she had. And I think that was probably one of the most formative things for me, was just having those conversations, frankly. So that's definitely the way I would try and influence them in terms of business.
Yeah, and I would definitely encourage you to start going now with the coaching, because by the time they get to 12 or 13, all you get is, oh, stop coaching me.
To make them think it's normal before that arrives.
Yeah, I get that all the time. Stop coaching me. I know what you're doing, they say.
Yeah, no, mine don't yet, so that's nice.
Sneak it in early, so then it'll just be normal by the time they're teenagers.
Yeah, no, I will.
What's your favourite way to build partnerships and networks? You've obviously had to do a lot of it. So do you have some favourite ways?
I love, have you read the book, How to Make Friends and Influence People?
I have.
I think it, like, so many fascinating things. The most dated book as well to read, and so slow to go. So in many ways, it's a tricky book. But it talks a lot about talking in the interests of others and trying to understand, you know, what is the person you're talking to interested in? What is their values in life? What are they, what makes them tick? And so when I come to networking, I'm genuinely trying to put down my motive as much as possible and enjoy understanding someone else and empathizing with someone else. Because I think, first of all, networking is quite interesting, isn't it? And I can't remember if your question was directly about networking, now I'm saying that. But networking is interesting because we're all basically meeting in an artificial setting, trying to get what we want from the person we meet, and then working out who else we should be talking to because this person isn't going to give us what we want.
That's the most honest description of networking I've ever had.
And so true.
And it is true.
And it's so dehumanizing. And I think it's also what makes it unenjoyable for people. So I've really enjoyed trying to come at networking differently, although I'm really goal orientated. So it just take effort. And it's working out, what if we didn't dehumanize this situation? And what if we genuinely became fascinated in your business and how it works being a relationships coach? And what it looks like to, from your perspective, what branding means. And so when I meet people, I try to really become fascinated in what they do, because it then becomes fascinating, and it also makes for a much more enjoyable chance to build a network that's meaningful, where actually I understand what you're looking for. So next time I meet someone, I'm actually able to represent you better as well and go, actually, you know, these guys are really interesting. Have you chatted to Matt recently about this or this? He was telling me about this. So I think in that way we can create really positive networks, and hopefully that's what I managed to do. And I think it does make a difference, because then when you ask someone, do you know anyone in X company? I'd love to chat with them. They actually really like you and you really like them. And so it's a genuine, like, yes, you're my friend. So here, let me drop you a line with the MD of that company. And so it ironically then becomes really fruitful as well, but also nicely human.
What would you ask people not to do in networking? Like, what's the worst thing people can do in networking?
Look over my shoulder to see who's behind me, to see if they're more interesting.
Does that happen a lot, Michael?
No, it doesn't, thankfully. But I do, and maybe because I'm hopefully engaging them well, but I do see other people doing it to other people. And I'm like, oh, I feel really sorry for the person that's literally being looked over.
You're so right. Because 90% of small business owners, I would say, go to networking in the sort of mind mode of, I need to sell.
Yeah. Right.
So if everyone in the room is in the mind mode of, I need to sell, who's buying? Because no one's in the mind mode of, I'm buying. Yeah. So if we just turn up and focus on building relationships with other people, and forget the buying and selling, that will come later.
It is usually the selling people that make me look over their shoulder, I have to say.
Yeah, this is a heavy sell. And I came here, frankly, because I like spending time with people and I wanted to help my business. But this is just me experiencing a sell.
Yeah. So, and you do tend to, at those points, glaze over a bit and go, oh, There must be someone that's actually interesting around here.
Interested in me or other humans in the room? Yeah.
I think networking can be really tough for some people, though, especially like small business owners who aren't necessarily massively confident or outgoing or extrovert, and they've got to go in this room full of other business owners and sell themselves. And yeah. As you said earlier, I think being passionate about what you do and really fully invested in it shines through more than anything.
Yeah. And that is the key. Are you running a business where it's life-giving and you can excel at it? Because I think, you know, when the CEO or the owner isn't experiencing life-giving work and they're not excelling in it, it's a tricky sell, isn't it? At that point, you're there trying to make things happen constantly and striving. I don't think there's an easy win to that. You get these really nice networking groups where you actually get to meet a lot of really good people. And those are the ones that I enjoy. I genuinely enjoy a good breakfast or like a 4 o'clock in the afternoon meeting where no one's thinking, oh, I've got a whole load of work I need to get into. They're just going, actually, let's build relationships here and see what happens.
We're going for a golf day on Friday, but I don't believe it involves very much golfing. So that's good. It does involve food. And that's, you know, it's a nice way to go out and see another place, isn't it? And meet people more casually. So, yeah, we've got Friday off to go and do that. There's a bit of networking, which is very cool.
Yeah. Networking aside, how else have you sort of grown the mission and spread the word? Because it sounds like you're not doing specific lead generation. It sounds like that's coming.
Yeah.
So how else have you spread the word, the mission, grown an audience?
Yeah, I think meeting people, whether it's at networking or not, and then saying to them, you know, if you were to name five really socially interested companies in the city, who would you name? And that's been really interesting to see, because, of course, what I'm looking for is large socially interested companies. And then do you know anyone in those companies? And it's been really interesting to see people's responses and the consistency of some of the names that come up, which is fantastic. And then it's just, yeah, so that's been really positive. To be honest, I think most of our lead generation is face-to-face, possibly some LinkedIn stuff, but I just love, yeah, spending time with people and understanding them understanding what I do and hoping that they get excited by it and hoping they tell their friends. The number of times I email someone and they say, oh, I was just talking to you about someone. And I'm thinking that is brilliant, because that is, you know, before I emailed you, you were talking to someone else about Upbeat Clean. I've won.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
So can you give those five top businesses a shout out?
Interesting. Cozy Direct is named nearly every time. Derby Museums, unsurprisingly, Derby County Community Trust. Ironically, it's largely our clients. Reach Events always gets a shout out. I would say those are the sort of four that get a consistent voice in that kind of situation. And you know, loads of others do as well. And that's partly why we work with all of those four. It's actually because it didn't take any time to realize that those were the ones that would be interested in what we're doing, because they want social impact and they're already spending on cleaning. So why not combine the two?
So from our point of view, that their whole brand and culture is doing a brilliant job, because everybody's talking about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is transparent. It's a consistent picture across the board that everybody knows. You pick Cozy, which I think is named every time. Everybody knows that Peter, I call him Peter Cozy. It's not his name. but everybody knows that that's what they're interested in and that they're passionate about that. And what a brand to build if that you're not even a social enterprise, you're not a charity. You've managed to still show the whole city that there is a way of running a business that makes profit and genuinely tries to year on year make a big social impact. We haven't yet managed to find a way of working together because of location. But it is really interesting to see when someone's managed to build that reputation in the city, the impact that has on everybody's way of thinking about them.
Yeah. And we're talking a lot about Derby because that's where we're all based. But this is the same within any city in the UK. You can go to any city and find out who are your big businesses that are interested in social enterprise, in making the world a better place. And Matt consistently talks about the fact that it's not actually government and those sorts of people that make change in the world. It is businesses.
Yeah, And interestingly, it's businesses that make a change, and then it's champions that make the change for you. And if you look in Derby, and I think this is true in every city, I was chatting with Bev Crichton last week. I had a coffee with her, and she said in every city, there's five people that are sort of known by everyone and influential in the city. And working out who those five are, because those are the five who will basically be able to open doors to you across the city. And I think of John Forkin, for example, from Marketing Derby. You know, he's a great example in Derby, and there are those in every city, individuals who have significant influence across many businesses. And when they understand a social impact is happening through a business, they're genuinely able to make more happen in 2 minutes of email than I could have done in 2 months of lead generation. And that's really fascinating when we realize who these champions are in the city that have that social impact as well as those networks and are willing to put their own time in to make that happen. That would 100% be for me. What's brought our growth.
That's such a brilliant tip for everybody listening that wants to develop a social enterprise, because
or any business.
Yeah.
Actually, we're talking about, you know, influence and networks. And connecting with the right people.
Yeah, no, I think that's fascinating, because it isn't just social enterprises. It's right for any small or medium business. If these people, if one of those five people likes what you do, like genuinely understands and likes what you do, they can open doors that you could never get through to. People always say to me, Michael, why don't you just approach this company? And it's always people who aren't in business, because anyone in business knows you don't just approach Rolls Royce. Like I know many people all over Rolls Royce, to give an example, and none of them are connected to the head of facilities at Rolls Royce by even a multiple jump. But it is those influential individuals who can go above that person that then brings the suggestion downwards that opens the door to the new contract. I guess anyone in any city, work out who are those five people. And how do I take them out for dinner?
Yeah.
And how do I take them out for dinner the second time? Or how do I build that relationship with them whereby we can both win?
And I think another great point is just to ask. Like, you have to be there to ask the people. If you don't ask, you don't get.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and that is really interesting, especially when you've got someone who likes what you do, is dropping. I again, to raise John Forkin, I wrote an email to him last week saying, you know, do you have any connection to X very large company? And, you know, he said yes. And then 2 minutes later, there was an email introduction. That you've got to ask, but you've got to have that relationship and know that they're genuinely interested in what you're doing. Otherwise, you're not going to move that forward anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's important to have clarity and conviction over what you're doing as well, so that you can build that relationship. Which you seem to have had right from day one.
Yeah, and I think people can sense when you have that, can't they? That's those top five influential people in the city, for example, are going to know whether you're the kind of person that holds that conviction and integrity or not, because they're smart people. And so if you can show that, then that opens that door.
Yeah.
So you've talked a bit about wanting to perhaps go into coaching and mentoring a bit more in the future, but you've got any more other future plans?
Work less. No, I think
What would working less mean for you? Because it's a really interesting thing, isn't it? I think lots of people say, "Oh, I want to do a 3-day week or whatever," but then that never happens. So, what would working less mean to you?
If I'm really honest, running a cleaning business, a large commercial cleaning business, is tiring. You know, you've got evenings. 6 o'clock this morning, one of my cleaners called me to say their husband's in hospital. You know, can they leave a shift early? You know, I was asleep. And so obviously I said yes and organized it all for them at 6 a.m. But it's all very glamorous, isn't it, to run a good sized social enterprise that's, you know, one of the fastest growing in the region, if not the country. Until you realize that actually it looks like waking up at 6 o'clock in the morning, taking a phone call and calling a few cleaners to see if you can fix something. I think that work-life balance in that way, although I don't work more than 40 hours, it is random hours. I look forward to that element of potentially of coaching where you don't have those emergency calls. But maybe I'll be bored of it. The challenge is exciting, isn't it? When you've got something that you can genuinely want to give your life to, then that's meaning, I guess. That's purpose straight up.
So if you're not doing that, what would your purpose be? Is it, do you have an interest in travel? Or I know lots of people like the idea of working from a beach, for example, but that's a very cliche thing these days, isn't it? Oh, I want to take my laptop and work on a beach. What would your vision be?
I have on my LinkedIn partnering to transform lives. And when I'm purely representing Upbeat Clean, it's partnering to transform lives through cleaning. But I think I've realized over the years that actually I do just genuinely enjoy partnering to transform lives. I think a beach surely has got to get boring after a month or 4 months or 6 months. Surely there's got to be a point where you think, where are my people? Where's the tribe that I could actually transform lives with? You know, and for me, that's an exciting purpose. For other people, I guess it's just raw cash. And don't get me wrong, I wouldn't mind having both. But like, yeah, I just think, what if I could spend more of my time than I even do now with people and bouncing great ideas off, building great ideas with them, developing new thoughts? And that's what I get to do already. But definitely that would be my thing. And to be honest, I probably wouldn't do fewer hours of it. Yeah.
I always say, when people ask, when do you want to retire? I don't have any plan to retire at all. I could coach, and when I'm 90, I'll be happily coaching away.
I can
maybe on the beach, maybe not.
Yeah, invite them to the beach to have a session.
Yeah.
I only coach on beaches.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
That could be part of your brand, I feel. Beach coach.
Beach coach. So if we uncovered Michael's secret sauce, then you're all about building tribes to change lives. Is that your secret sauce?
That's, I think, what I'm passionate about. Yeah, is genuinely seeing impact and building something exciting with people I actually want to spend time with.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. Love it. Great. Well, I'm going to do my nearest attempt I can get to being a host on Desert Island Discs now, and I'm going to ask you for one book, one piece of music, and one tool that has completely changed your life and that you would recommend to other people.
Oh wow, definitely need to think about this. Book, Jim Collins, select any of the above. Good to Great, I think, is just absolutely packed full. I did a degree in management leadership and it included Lane books. It wasn't at Derby University, just to clarify. I don't know where they found their book collection from, but I think Jim Collins, I wish that was in my course. Just non-stop profound ideas for how to build a business that actually will sustain and grow over time. So that would definitely be my book. Music, I love the belters, Whitney Houston, Mariah Carey. I want to hear raw talent when I listen to music. I don't want to hear popular. As in, I don't mind pop if it's talented pop, but I want to actually hear why you were picked, not just that it was luck. And you listen to some of the sort of classic Whitney Houston, Mariah Carey tracks. I'm trying to think of any of them right now off the top of my head. But they're just, you can hear the musicality. I come from a musical background, and you can just hear the raw talent. So that would definitely win for me. Tools, 90-day planning. It's a, like, I know it's a business tool, but I'm obsessed. My coach introduced me to, he's an action coach, 2 or 3 years ago, and I am obsessed with picking your three priorities each quarter that work out over the years. So that's not just a random three that you had to get done, but picking those three priorities and focusing on nothing else but them in this quarter. Yeah, Measure What Matters is a great book on 90-day planning. What was the last thing? Was that it?
Yes, that's it.
That was it. Do you play an instrument?
Yes, piano. I used to play the violin a lot, but now just piano and guitar. And I teach my kids, both of them. They've got the Simply Piano app. And so the app teaches them, and I'm the sort of tutor on the side.
Nice.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Probably just as well you gave up the violin. I played the violin briefly. Didn't like the teacher.
It has limited use once you've finished impressing your friends at school. And also there's a point at which your friends aren't that impressed at school anymore. Whereas piano and guitar, I think, are the sort of everyday instruments that we can all enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. You taught yourself piano, didn't you?
So I taught myself piano, yeah. I taught myself piano so that I could be in the band, because everyone already did guitars and bass and, you know.
Found a niche.
Found my niche, absolutely.
Love it.
Great. Well, just one more question, I think, and that is, what one piece of advice would you give to someone who wants to start a business or social enterprise?
I think it's definitely start with the end in mind.
Yeah.
What is it you want to actually build 10 years from now? You're sitting there 10 years from now and you're absolutely chuffed that you've built something great. What is it that you're sitting there and going, I'm so glad I flipping built this? Like, really draw it out. Like, really think, what's the scale of it? What's the impact of it? Who are you employing? Who are you working with? Who's your customers that you're enjoying spending time with or learning from? Really draw it out and then work from there backwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. Great advice.
It's a great strategy.
Yeah.
Think of the future and work and backwards engineer it.
Yeah. That's the phrase.
Thank you, Michael, for joining us. It's been so great to have you on. And I know that there will be a lot of value in there.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's been I'm not regular on podcasts, so I'm sorry if I've rambled on, but no,
it's been amazing. Is there anything that you want to say to anybody that we haven't covered?
Oh, interesting. Could I do a shameless sales pitch?
Yeah, please.
If you're interested in transforming lives, get in touch, especially if you're based in Derby and your company already spends plenty of money on cleaning. I'd love to chat to you about how we can make a massive impact to individuals who come from everywhere, from Ukraine to Eritrea to El Salvador, who have fled with their families, horrific situations, but actually just need an opportunity to rebuild their lives. And so I'd love to chat to large, medium-sized businesses about how they can make a massive social impact with a really boring budget.
Amazing. And how can people get in touch with you?
Go on upbeatclean.co.uk or michael@upbeatclean.co.uk if you want to contact me directly. Yeah, I'd love to hear from people.
Great. And we'll put a few links in the show notes.
Perfect. Thank you.
I know this is probably an end of podcast episode deviation, but are there any stories from your cleaners that you can share that are going to inspire people?
There we go, a PS to the podcast.
Yeah, PS to the podcast. I think one of the most inspiring ones for me is one of our cleaning managers. Her husband was in the police there and needed to flee basically because of the situation there. As you can imagine, if you don't take bribes, it's highly dangerous. So fleeing with your kids to another country because of significant threats to life, and then just the raw drive and tenacity to not only survive the asylum situation in this country, which is dire, where you're basically forced into unemployment for multiple years because they stop you from finding a job, even if you're desperate to work, and then just to find work that you can thrive at and work as many hours as you can to support your family and then step upwards in terms of leading teams and managing. To me, I think refugees have this image in this country of, to be frank, dirty people on boats. They passed the borders bill when we were recording this last night, and it is a propaganda machine basically painting people as dirty people coming on boats to either steal your jobs or claim benefits, and probably both in some really confusing way. But actually what you've got is people who, like any of us, would have fled to save their children, fled to save their families, and are genuinely looking for just a safe country where they can earn a reasonable income and support their kids. And it is a real privilege to see individuals like that really grab life here with two hands and fight to make an impact in their lives. So,
great. Yeah. Thank you. Anything you want to finish with?
No, I don't think we should after that. I think that's a really important and powerful note to finish on. So thank you very much for sharing.
Yeah, thank you very much, guys. It's been a pleasure.
Quick one before you go. If you want to grab a free PDF download copy of my new book, Being Bold, How to Use Brand and Human Transformation to Skyrocket Your Growth, just drop into the show notes where I'll put a link to your free copy.